In this episode of Cube FM, I got a chance to speak to Michael Levin, who is an engineer, content creator, and trainer. Michael's also not afraid to share his opinions, and in this conversation, we will spend a lot of time looking at his ideas about how silos that have long been thought to be an enemy for organizations can actually be a good thing. Michael brings a fresh, unapologetic perspective that you definitely will not want to miss. In this episode, you'll learn about the surprising reasons why silos might actually help your teams thrive, how to cut through the chaos of Kubernetes tools with smart abstractions, and why not everyone needs to be a Kubernetes expert or even touch YAML. If you're building platforms, looking for clarity in today's noisy tech world, or just here for some creative, candid career advice, stick around. Michael's insights just might change how you see engineering, or they certainly might change how you think about silos. This episode of Cube FM is sponsored by TestCube. TestCube is the ultimate testing control plane for Kubernetes, designed to streamline your testing workflow and empower QA and DevOps teams. It leverages Kubernetes to run any testing tool at scale, whether manually, automatically, or integrated into your CI/CD pipelines. By decoupling test configuration and execution from CI/CD, TestCube provides a single pane of glass for advanced test troubleshooting, centralized reporting, and efficient debugging. With TestCube, you can ensure consistent reporting and scale your testing effortlessly. Ready to level up your testing game? Check out TestCube today. Now, let's get into the episode. Hi, Michael. Welcome to Cube FM. What are three emerging Kubernetes tools that you're keeping an eye on?
Oh, good question. I would say anything in the GitOps realm currently, so primarily Argo CD, anything in the resource optimization realm, and there are so many of those, right? Carpenter is probably my favorite. There are a lot of cloud-based solutions as well, right? Like virtual machine scale sets and, you know, stuff that's like built into Azure and AWS and GCP. And what's the third one? I would say anything in the self-service realm. So internal developer platforms or portals or whatever you want to call it. Backstage is a really cool one. I actually really like Port. Port, I believe, is a free version, and they have an enterprise version as well, but it's a really, really solid IDP. Yeah, so I would say probably those three things. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Now, for people who don't know you, can you tell us a little bit more about what you do and who you work for?
Yeah, absolutely. So what do I do? That's a great question. So I do a little bit of engineering, a lot of product currently, actually. That's pretty new. So really, really focused on product lately from an engineering perspective. So more of like the PLG product-led growth stuff. But my background has always been in engineering. So the whole like focusing on product thing is very, very new, probably like a couple months. Whereas my entire career has always been everything from the infrastructure side to the development side. Started out my career in systems administration, about halfway through moved to software development, about halfway through that. Found myself somewhere in the middle, right? Whether you want to call it an SRE or DevOps realm or platform engineering or whatever. But I always like to incorporate the two. I really, really enjoy the theory and practice and implementation of distributed systems as a whole, which require, you know, both development and infrastructure knowledge.
And how did you get into cloud native?
Honestly, for me, it was probably more luck than anything else. I've always been a little bit of an overachiever. I've always been the person that felt the most comfortable working 7 days a week and working the 12, 13 hour days and just really diving into what I wanted to dive into. That's just what I like personally. Like I like being, you know, in the hustle version of myself. You know, that's just what I enjoy personally. So because of that, I always found myself in startups. And with startups, you're always working with the new, latest, and greatest thing. So for me, it was just, you know, cloud hit. I was working on that. Same thing with Kubernetes. Like I started working with Kubernetes 2016 because like I was working at a startup. It was 20 people. And at the time, we were trying to figure out, are we going to go Mesos? Are we going to go Swarm? Are we going to go Kubernetes? What are we going to do? Because I was always, we were always on the latest and greatest because of, you know, being in startup land.
And what were you before cloud native?
I would say definitely more systems administration on the Windows side. Cloud brought me more into the Linux realm, but my career started out like managing Active Directory and managing Exchange and Office 365 and every type of Windows server you can think of, from file servers to print servers and everything in between. Yeah, so that's really where I got my start. You know, the MCSA, MCSE, land, all that good stuff.
And, you know, the Kubernetes and cloud native ecosystem moves very quickly. What works best for you to stay up to date? Is it, you know, would you say blogs, podcasts, videos? What's your choice?
Yeah, I would say D, all of the above. I consume a lot of different knowledge. Again, just going back to like how I like to work and how I like to stay busy. I'm the type of person that likes to go 7 days a week. So, you know, in the morning, I get up and the first thing that I do in the morning before I hit the gym is read for about an hour. And it's always like an engineering book or it's always a psychology book to help me with better my mind for studies and work and all that good stuff. So really for me, it's just a matter of like constantly going and never really taking a break. I don't get burnt out all that easily. Sometimes I do, but yeah, that advice isn't for everybody because I know, you know, some people don't work that way, but that's the way I do it.
And if you could go back in time and give yourself one, you know, career tip, what would it be?
Yeah, I think I would definitely say continue to just believe in what you know to be right, and what you know to be true, right? And I don't want people to confuse that with, you know, being all about yourself and thinking you're always right and being, you know, mean and not taking other people's opinion. That's not what I'm referring to. What I'm referring to is like, don't be the yes person, you know, want to show your side of things. But remember, when you show your side of things, make sure that you can back it up. Like I have this rule for myself. I don't open my mouth unless I know with certainty I'm correct. If I don't know I'm correct, I'll always say something along the lines of like, I'm not 100% sure about this, or I could be wrong, but yeah. So I always make sure people know, like, I know that I'm right, or there's a possibility that I'm not, and I'll let you know. I think that's like the best thing that I would tell myself and continue to tell myself.
With that in mind, you know, we can address the elephant in the room right away. You wrote an article that says organizational silos are good. Now, that point might be quite controversial in today's DevOps or platform engineering world. What made you take this stance?
I know you've been in engineering for a long time as well. So if we go back to kind of like, maybe we go back to like early 2000s you know, 10, 15 years ago, let's say. There was a time where like everybody was just doing their own thing, right? You had the sysadmins doing their thing. You had the front end folks doing their thing, the back end folks doing their thing, the QA folks doing their thing, et cetera, right? And there were, you know, things tossed over the brick wall, so to speak. And there was a portion of that where I think there was some confusion. So again, like I said before, I'm very into cognitive science and psychology. One of my hobbies, for whatever reason, is understanding the way that the human mind works. I'm really, really into it. So I think what ended up happening was people were like, yeah, we need to break down these walls and we need to, you know, let people work together and all of these things because we're going to get better results. The reality of all that, which this probably breaks the notion of DevOps as well, right? Because DevOps kind of came out to not be a title, but to be this whole let's break the silo thing. We didn't need to break silos. We just needed to break egos. So egos were the thing that were getting everybody in the way of each other, right? What's the example? The example is a dev would throw code over the fence and say, hey, you figure out how to run it. Why would they do that? Well, I don't think they did it because they woke up that morning saying to themselves, I want to be a bad person today. I'm going to make this person's life incredibly difficult. No, they had an ego. They're like, my stuff works. It's my code. I know it works. It's not working for you. You figure it out. It's an ego thing. It's not a silo thing. So I think what silos brought were the ability to be really, really good at what you did, to be really focused in what you did. But because we, you know, broke the notion of silos, what ended up happening? Well, everybody had to do a little bit of everything. Nobody could focus on one thing. Nobody could become as close to an expert or an expert as possible in what they do. And therefore, we're now living in the world that we're living in now, which is nobody knows what to do. Everybody's confused. Oops, sorry. The little thing popped up. There are too many tools. Nobody knows where to start. And this isn't just entry-level engineers either. Like, I'm not talking about people that are just graduating with CS degrees or people that are 18, 19 and just kind of breaking into tech without college. I'm talking about people that are senior principal level as well. I mean, everybody's like, what tool do I use? Where do I start? What do I learn? All of this stuff seems important. I have to know everything. And in my opinion, I think that's because we got this notion in our head of like, if we break the silos, or in other words, if everybody does a little bit of everything, all of our problems are going to go away. And again, my opinion, right? I think it broke more than it fixed.
Keeping that in mind, but before we go any further, could you help us understand what you mean by team silos in this context? Because I think some people might have different definitions, so it's just helpful to have a common framework.
100%. Yeah. So the definite, I feel like we kind of made up what silo meant in tech, right? Like the definition of a silo is pretty much a trench. So a trench is, you know, obviously you're in there with a team of people, right? Like if you're thinking military wise, you're in the trenches with people. We hear that a lot, right? Like we're in the trenches. You're with a particular team. Maybe again, it's a front end team. It's a back end team. It's the Windows team. It's the Linux team. It's the security operations center or SOC. It's the pen testers and the red team, whoever it is, right? Like these are all team silos. And that's the way I think about it. Like I think about it from like, you know, being in the trenches.
And it's interesting because, you know, traditionally organizational silos describe teams that have no idea what other teams are doing. And, you know, usually it has nothing to do with expertise. How do you reconcile these different interpretations?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think, again, it goes back to the psychology of the human mind. Those definitions that you gave, right? You're 100% correct. Those are 100% accurate. The thing is, what makes them accurate? It's somebody that goes into an organization, somebody in the leadership team or middle management or director or VP that says, this is our definition. Now, is that opinion? Or is that fact? I don't know. I think the lines kind of blur sometimes, right? Between what's opinionated and what's factual. I think the best way to combat it, honestly, is, in my opinion, take the verbiage out of it. Like if what I'm saying, if you call it something else, call it that. I'm not stuck on the title of it. If there's a better title for it, if I'm calling it the wrong thing, feel free to let me know. I'm totally open to it. But I think it's less about thinking about the title of what the thing is and more about, you know, the underlying meat of it, if that makes sense.
And, you know, you mentioned this, the historical development, but, you know, for context, for the past decade, we've been taught that sharing responsibilities is good. That's why we have DevOps combining dev and ops. Now, your point seems to be addressing that team silos are good. How do these seemingly opposing views reconcile and perhaps share the same space?
Yeah, 100%. So my whole take on it is, I think, you know, sharing's caring, right? Talking to people, having communication, open teams, having the ability to walk into one team's cubicles and say, hey, what's going on? You know, you guys want to get lunch or do whatever. And on the opposite side of it, you know, you want to be able to work with your team as well. That stuff isn't bad. What's bad to me is the fact that we expect everybody to do everything. Okay. And the majority of the human mind isn't built that way. Like, for example, I don't believe in multitasking. Why don't I believe in multitasking? Because if you dive into psychology and understand that the way that the brain works, by definition, you cannot multitask. You cannot do two things at 100% capacity at the same time. And I think that the same thing goes for the work that we do. So if you're expecting people to be really, really good at writing a microservice, right, or a decoupled application, whatever you feel like calling it, and then the next day you say to them, hey, figure out an entire scaling strategy and HA and DR and everything for our data center. You can't be 100% good at all of it at the same time. That's not the way that the human mind works. Now, do some people defy that? Sure. We have people that are really, really good in the world at multiple different things. But what they do is they take a chunk of something, do it at 100% for a couple days or a week or a month or whatever, and then they move on to the next thing and they follow that same protocol. They're never doing multiple things at the same time because by definition, you cannot do that at 100% capacity. It's literally impossible, but you can chunk it out, right? Just as long as you have the mental capacity to be able to hold all that information in your head and compartmentalize it in your brain. So that's the long-winded answer to one of your questions. And then how do I kind of see, like, let's say there's an opposing argument and somebody's like, hey, okay, I see what you're saying, but we also want to do it this way. I guess the best answer that I have for that is look at the current state of tech. The number one thing, I mean, you know, you go on Reddit, you go on LinkedIn, you go on X, you go whatever, wherever you hang out, what is the number one thing that people are talking about? How do I learn this? How do I figure this out? What's the most important thing? What should I be learning next? What should I be focused on? And now all these questions stem from, you know, you got 100 options in front of you and you're like, uh-oh, what do I do? And this again is a psychology thing. If you put multiple options in front of somebody, your brain will almost short circuit in a sense. It doesn't want to pick anything because there are too many options. But if you put a couple of options in front of somebody, they'll be able to differentiate which one is the most important. So I don't know if that answers the question. That's the best answer I got.
That's fair. And one thing, you know, a term that's used very often, particularly when we're talking about Kubernetes, is the idea of abstraction. Can you talk about how you view abstraction in this context and why abstractions might be important?
Yeah, 100%. So I think this definitely goes back to everything that we're talking about, which is not everybody can be good at everything, which is why platform engineering is so important to me. Platform engineering, if it's done right, I mean, and it could be called something different in a couple months, in a couple of years, whatever, but we're calling it platform engineering because that's just what we're calling it now. So if I go back maybe 7-8 years ago, I think my title at the time was like senior principal cloud or infrastructure engineer, something. But I liked writing code. So that's what I did. And I remember the dev team came over and they said, hey, you know, we want to use the AWS SDK or in the command line tool or the command line interface. But there's like a lot of options and everybody's overwhelmed and nobody knows which direction to go in. And is there any way to make this kind of easier for us? And I said, sure thing. So what did I do? I built a command line tool wrapped around the AWS SDK that only exposed a couple of commands that they needed. That way, they weren't overwhelmed. They only had the commands and the flags / subcommands that they needed, and they were able to go on about their day. That to me is a level of abstraction that takes what you need or takes what the person needs and gives it to them in a logical way. Like that to me is platform engineering. Now that could be an IDP as well. It could be whatever you want it to be. Just as long as you keep the notion in your head of this team over here needs to be able to do a thing, but they're not experts in it. And nor should they be because they don't need to be. They need to be experts in what they're doing. Hence silos. So I would actually maybe play devil's advocate against myself as I usually do. I argue with myself in my head often that platform engineering by definition gives you the ability to create better silos, right? It's taking the need for everybody to know everything and putting that on the platform engineer essentially to know a little bit of everything, a team dedicated to know a little bit of everything. And that team makes the lives of everybody else easier so everybody else can continue to be experts or as close to experts as possible in their space, hence creating silos.
And with that in mind too, in terms of the specialization and knowledge, you made an interesting statement in the article that not everyone needs to be Kubernetes experts. this might sound great for developers in our audience who would say, hey, one less thing to learn, right? But could this also create the challenge where a single person becomes the expert and also a single point of failure or a bottleneck? Everybody knows that there's, in thinking about it this way, if everybody knows that there is the Kubernetes person, but when that person's gone, no one knows how to deploy anymore. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. You know, I'm sure you can attest to this as well in your career. I remember early on in my career, there was always the king of the castle. Like there was always somebody that held the keys to everything, which definitely is not good at all. Like we definitely do not want that, which is why I think that we should have teams versus just one person that does it all. Like the platform engineering team should be, you know, I like the I forget what it's called, like that, the pizza pie team size. I forget who made that up, but it's like 5 to 8 people. And then if you have more than that, you need to create a new team. And that may be the case. Like there may be a front end platform engineering team. There may be a back end platform engineering team. Who knows? But yes, I totally agree with you. Like there should never be one person that knows it all. And if for whatever reason, but here's the other reality. If you're working at a startup, chances are you're going to have one person that knows it all. That's just the way that it works. But that person needs to understand that everything that they know, they got to document it properly. I mean, I would say technical documentation is more important than implementation, because anybody can implement anything, right? Like anybody can write code, anybody can run a CI/CD pipeline, whatever it is, but you need to be able to build out those repeatable processes for everybody to be able to use. And again, you know, I think personally, like that comes back to psychology again, where it's like there, you could have somebody that's working at a startup that likes their job security. You know, they're the wizards of where they work. You know, like they're holding, they want that job security. They don't want to share it with anybody else. And unfortunately, again, that just goes back to, you know, it's funny, right? Because things always come back to it being a people problem, not a technology problem.
A previous guest that we had on the podcast named Hans mentioned that instead of shifting left, we should be shifting down. His arguments, we can say, generally align with yours, because he mentioned that practices such as GitOps can foster the types of interactions and abstractions that you describe. Have you seen similar patterns in your experience? And if so, are there any tools that you've seen promoting shifting down?
Yes. I'm not a salesperson and I don't want to promote anything. But what I will say is I was self-employed for a very long time. And now I'm working at a company that's building exactly what you just said. And the reason why I stopped being self-employed to go work at this company to build it is because of all the stuff that we're talking about. So yes, there is a solution out there. It is the place that I'm working at, but I don't want to promote anything. So
fair enough. But you did mention Argo when we started out the conversation. Could GitOps and Argo be an example of that as well?
Yeah, I think so. Here's the thing about the overall abstraction piece, right? So Argo CD gives you the ability to have a central source of truth, right? That central source of truth is in your repo or multiple repos, and it's a bunch of YAML configurations. So anything that changes in there gets deployed to wherever you're running. Now, 100%, that solves part of the problem, but it doesn't solve all the problem, because there's always a pro and a con, right? So yes, that solves that problem, but guess what? Now you need people that are really, really good at writing, managing, configuring Kubernetes manifests. So you got tons and tons and tons of YAML all over the place, which is another problem within itself. So it's like all these tools that currently exist, they solve, you know, 20-30% of the problem, but almost none solve 100% of the problem.
In terms of other tools that might be out there when we're thinking about abstraction, additional solutions, you know, we're thinking about Kubernetes infrastructure work. Could you maybe touch on what you've seen with serverless solutions like ACI or Fargate?
Yeah, so maybe I could answer the question. If it's okay with you, I'd like to answer the question in a way of like, what problem should we be solving for to really get this abstraction going in the right direction? So the first piece is, okay, so we got a couple of different layers here. We got the underlying platform, which is like maybe Kubernetes, right? Or VMs or bare metal or serverless or whatever. Now the goal is, well, what's the goal of any company? Deploy and run software in a performant way. How do you do that? Well, you got to have good networking and you got to have good underlying infrastructure and you got to have good clusters and all that, right? But still, what is the value proposition here? The value proposition at the end of the day, I need this software deployed, running, and performing as expected. So for example, what do you not need to know to do that? Well, you really shouldn't think about the underlying platforms, right? So yeah, the underlying platforms need to, of course, be there. Whether you're using serverless or you're using Kubernetes or whatever you're using, those platforms need to be there, but you really shouldn't have to think about managing a cluster. Yeah, the cluster needs to be there, but maybe you could think about it in like a blue-green fashion. So yeah, you have clusters running, but if one goes away, a new one comes up magically, right? Because of automation going on underneath the hood, and you're thinking about a cluster now as like a blue-green or a canary deployment, just like you would with software. And then the next piece up is, okay, well, what are my platform capabilities? Okay, well, if I'm running in Kubernetes, what do I need to know currently? I need to know, well, I mean, I think pretty much everybody kind of knows YAML at this point, right? But YAML, because of its, because it's a configuration language, YAML is different everywhere that it runs, right? It's based off of the platform that it's running on. So now you need to know a bunch of YAML. Well, do you actually need to know that to get the product out into the wild? Do you need that? Do you need to know that for the entire SDLC process? Do you need that to measure the performance of the product that's being deployed? No, you don't. Okay, so boom, now let's remove the need for YAML, right? And let's give an easier method of configurating whatever your application is. Because what are YAML configurations? YAML configurations are key value pairs, right? This is the thing that should be running. Replicas, two, container image, Nginx latest, whatever, right? So these are just key value pairs. So let's give people an easier way to give key value pairs. And then finally, we need to, and this is going to be, people are going to hate me, but that's okay. We need to remove so much of this method of configuration, right? Like we have multiple different IAC platforms. We have multiple different YAML-based platforms. Ansible YAML looks different than Kubernetes YAML. So we got all these different ways to deploy. We need to just make this way simpler. Like you need a command line tool and you need a UI. If you like doing things programmatically, configure it in the CLI. If you like to do things from a visual perspective, do it in the UI. And if we just tweak those things that I was just talking about and we do it in that way, the majority of confusion will go away. And we're now only going to be focused on the application needs to be deployed. It needs to be running in a specific way to be as performant as possible. And that's it. Boom, done. And that's this simplification of software. Now, how do we get there? Yeah, it's a long road. Again, it's something that I'm literally working on as we speak. And we're there. You know, we're 95% of the way there. So it's doable. It just takes a while and it takes a good team.
Taking Fargate or Google Cloud Run as examples.
Yep.
Could we say that we're just trading one problem for another if we, you know, get easier abstractions but end up locked into their platforms? Is there some kind of way for us to avoid this, you know, to have our cake and eat it too?
Absolutely. And you're 100% correct. Like if we're using, so for example, Cloud Run is Borg underneath the hood, right? So if we're using ECS, same, it's just serverless underneath the hood, right? You're using EKS with worker nodes, you're using EKS with Fargate profiles. Fargate profiles with EKS give you the ability to not have to worry about the EC2 instances. You're using Azure Container Apps, you're using Azure Container Instances. You're using Kubernetes running on bare metal, right? You got a couple of Ubuntu boxes and you bootstrap with kubeADM. You're absolutely right. Like we're literally just shifting blame, right? What I'm saying is, do we even have to care? Like, seriously, think about it. let's say you need an application to be running, right? It needs to be as performant as possible. It needs to be up. It needs to be highly scalable, so it's always running. And it needs to be scalable based on load, right? Like if you have an e-commerce website, Cyber Monday is going to be one of your busiest days. In the grand scheme of things, does it really matter where it's running? And we've kind of already proved that it doesn't, right? Because, for example, let's say we take AKS. AKS gives you the ability to do ACI bursting, which means you don't spin up new worker nodes. You deploy the pods to ACI. So we've already proved it really doesn't matter where your application is running. Who cares? And that's how we should be thinking about it. Like the underlying infrastructure, because to your point, we're just shifting blame. So realistically, who cares? We shouldn't care. We should just care about the scalability of it, right? We should care about the ability of this cluster goes down, a new one comes up, right? Whatever you want to call it, cluster, server, whatever, it doesn't matter. Like we should know that that's going to happen, but we shouldn't be managing it or shifting the blame from one product to another. It doesn't make any sense.
You know, platform engineering has exploded in popularity in the last couple of years, partly because it means different things to different people, but also because a segment of people recognize themselves in that role. How do you define platform engineering, and what should these teams do?
Yeah, so the way that I think about platform engineering is customer service. You are 100% in a customer service role, and you are 100% a product engineer. You are running product. As a platform engineer, you should be thinking about product, and you should be thinking about customer service. Why? Because the whole idea of platform engineering is to make the lives of other teams easier, right? You're building internal products for your engineers internally to make their lives easier, so they don't have to learn and worry about all these different tools and have to become experts in a million and one things, because we already know that that's not going to work. That's my definition of platform engineering. I think that platform engineering is the ability to create internal methods, which is based off of software, for other teams to make their lives easier. Like if a development team says, hey, we need something like a GitOps solution, we should be able to give them a GitOps solution without them having to know what it is underneath the hood. Is it Flux? Is it Argo? Is it Weave? Who cares? We should give them an easy way to do it, and that's it. And we manage it as the platform engineers.
So is this platform engineering team then essentially in charge of tuning the balance between organizational silos and abstractions?
100%. Spot on. Yep, totally. The whole idea here is we want to give people just enough abstraction to be able to do their job, but not be robotic. So it's a lot of customer service. Let's say you're a platform engineer and you're building an internal tool set to make the lives of front-end engineers easier. Guess what? You got to go and you got to talk to these platform engineers, and you got to understand how they're feeling, and you got to understand their pain, and you got to understand how can you resolve that pain for them. Very, very important. Funny enough, platform engineering is more sales and customer service than it is engineering. It's understanding pain and fix it and doing your best to fix that pain.
You know, one of the things you mentioned previously is this sort of pressure for people to, you know, have knowledge about absolutely everything, the sort of idea of, you know, jack of all trades. We've reached that point where there is sometimes, you know, that knowledge overload or, you know, expectations that people can, you know, be experts about everything. This is unsustainable. Do you see this trend continuing, or is there a more realistic path forward? What are your thoughts on that?
You know how with cybersecurity, people kind of care about it and they understand that it's important, but they don't really do it at 100% until stuff hits the fan, so to speak. I think that that's the same thing with what we're dealing with right now. Like there's going to come a time where people are just going to feel so much pain from this that the world will shift. And again, that's totally a people problem. That's not like a product problem. There's just going to be a time where everybody's going to feel pain and everybody's going to feel it at the same time. And then naturally we're going to shift, right? And we're going to do it in a different way. And honestly, that's pretty normal. Like the difference between humans and animals is that, you know, humans are self-aware, animals are not. Humans can be blamed for how they are because they can change. Animals can only be blamed for their training. So the thing that's similar between animals and humans is that we're pack animals, right? Humans are pack animals. We're not meant to be by ourselves. That's why, what's the worst thing that they can do to you in prison? Solitary confinement. We're not meant to be by ourselves. We're meant to be with others. So what ends up happening in society is everybody kind of feels the same way. And then that's when shift happens. So I think that we're there. I think that we're feeling it. I think that people are really starting to put their foot down in terms of like, this is too much. We need a better way to do things. We need the next thing. We are now fully prepared for the next thing. And I believe we will be there very soon.
You know, we've covered a lot in this conversation, but you know, it did all start with the topic of organizational silos. If both team silos and abstractions are good, how would you recommend balancing the two to support developers in a typical organization? I imagine that there are a lot of companies that are out there that are building platform teams, and your advice could help them avoid mistakes and build a more robust foundation.
Yeah, so it's a good question because my answer really doesn't have anything to do with the tech, to be honest. I'm probably a broken record at this point, but it really all comes back to the psychology of the human mind. Like, if you want to do silos and abstraction and make sure that every team has what they need, the best way to do that, learn and understand psychology, learn and understand the human mind. Like, every leader in an organization, whether you're an HR or you're a technology executive or you're a CMO or whoever, if you're leading the path, because the leadership team leads the path in an organization, you should learn about psychology. You should learn about cognitive science. You should understand the way that the human mind works. If you just do that, and you don't even worry about the tech stuff, like, get the tech stuff out of your head. Don't even think about that. If you just think about the psychology of the way that people work and how people respond and what works best for the majority of people, you're going to be in a very, very, very good place. And sorry, I don't know if that's the answer that you were looking for, but I think that's the best one that I have. It's really just a people thing.
Okay. You know, you've clearly have a lot of strong opinions, and I think it's healthy that you're you know, that you express them in the way that you do and that you're willing to share them. One that you shared recently was that open source is going to take a nosedive. Can you share your opinion with our listeners and tell them how you think open source will evolve in the coming years?
For sure. Yeah. So this is something that I did not make up, by the way. This is just what we've seen statistically. So statistically, we have seen enterprise tools be the thing and then open source be the thing. And then open source comes up and enterprise goes down. Right, we saw it with the former CEO of Microsoft, Steve Ballmer, when he was like, "Linux is the devil" type of deal, you know. And then years later, what was everybody doing? Everybody was doing open source, and VCs were literally throwing money at open source in 2019. I mean, there was so much money being thrown at open source tools from VCs, to the point where it dried up, and the majority of open source tools now are trying to get funding, and it's really, really difficult. So this is just a statistic that we see. Open source goes up, it goes down, and then enterprise tooling goes up, and then enterprise tooling goes down, and open source goes up. We've seen that for 30, 40, 50 years. So I think we're just in the dip right now of open source. And the reason why is because of this. For a product to move, for people to build the product, people need to make money, right? People need to be paid. Unless somebody wants to take on the initiative to build every single tool and not get paid. I don't know how they will have homes or food, but if they want to take on that initiative, they can. Open source, regardless of it being open source or not, the people that are building it, the founders, the employees, they need to make money. To make money, the product itself needs to make money in a particular way. Now, typically with open source tools, you see support plans, right? You can use the tool for free, you can contribute to it, etc. But there's a support plan that you can buy. nobody buys the support plans. So the product isn't making any money. Now, the other thing about open source is, and I'll be honest, a lot of people push for open source, but I think really what they're asking for is a freemium model, right? Because whenever somebody says to me, this thing needs to be open source, my first question is, how many open source projects do you contribute code to on a daily basis? If you're not contributing to open source, you don't need open source. You need free. That's what you're looking for. So I think that the freemium model and the free trial model is going to come back in light now. And so what's going to end up happening is, now that we're going more into this enterprise loop of tools, products are going to be more focused on something called product-led growth, PLG, which is essentially you have a bottom-up strategy, right, where you make the product sell itself, right? People get the value from it literally in the first 5 to 15 seconds. Top down is the sales stuff, right? It's like you ever go to try a tool and you get the prompt to type in your first name and your last name and your email, and it says somebody will get back to you. That's top down. Nobody cares. Nobody wants to do that. That's icky, right? We want to go bottom up. We want to be able to give people a free method of using the tool, but at the same time, have the ability for the vendor to make the money. And the reason why we need to do that right now is because, like I was saying before, VCs aren't throwing money at open source tools the way that they used to. So the best way for an open source tool to really thrive and succeed is to be built under or bought by an enterprise. We're seeing IBM gobbling up stuff. We're seeing Cisco gobbling up stuff. We're seeing Microsoft gobbling up stuff. The tools are staying open source that they're gobbling up, but they're now under an umbrella of a company that's making money. And therefore, because that company is making money, they can fund that open source project. So I think we're in that enterprise upscale now.
Okay. Now, you mentioned this previously, but that you recently changed jobs from going from being an independent contractor to being a full-time employee. I read your thread on X and the reasoning behind it, and I respect your change. I'm an independent creator. I've been working as a freelancer for the last 8 years, and it's a rewarding yet tricky job, as you usually have to wear, you know, so many hats. Can you share any tips for other engineers that are out there that are, you know, wanting to share their knowledge with others and perhaps create a business out of it?
For sure. The reason why I wanted to shut my self-employment down is because, and I'm sure you feel this way as well because you're in it too. There was a time where people that were independent would get a call, right, from a vendor or from a company that wanted you to do consulting because you were really good at what you did. Now it seems that people are getting calls based on how buzzy they are, right? Or how many likes or comments or views or whatever they get on social media. I'm not saying this is for everybody, but for me personally, I don't like that. I want to get the call based on if I'm good at something versus how many likes I get on a post. And therefore, for me right now, the self-employment thing, at least in what we do in tech, wasn't where I needed to be, because I want to be able to provide value based on where I see value. So my biggest piece of advice is understand what you're getting into at this point. Understand where you want to provide value, because there are a lot of people that get value out. Like, for example, right? One of the best tech YouTubers, Network Chuck, right? His stuff, like, he's got, I think, millions of subscribers, right? But his stuff is more entertaining than it is hardcore engineering, because that's not his audience. His audience is, I want to get you into tech and I want to show you an exciting way to do it. And that's where he gets value for himself. Where you get value for yourself, whoever's listening to this and watching, your value may come from somewhere else. So the biggest piece of advice, if you're looking to start your own business or whatever, understand what value means to you and understand that it may not be the same as everybody else. Just know yourself at your core.
Fantastic. That's great advice. Now, in your case, Michael, what's next for you?
I am really kind of obsessed with product right now. I want to be able to, so like, I spent my time, my entire 99% of my career writing code and building cool stuff. What I want to do is I want to kind of go a level up, and instead of writing code, I want to think about how can a vendor show their value? And more importantly, how can they get that value out into the wild? Because that's the hardest thing right now. I mean, like, there's so many vendors and there are so many different tools and they're all trying to figure out the same thing. How do we get people to try our stuff? How do we get people to care about our stuff? How do we get people interested and excited? And that's like, those are the number one problems that literally every single vendor has. And that's kind of exciting to me. Like, for me, I'm really thinking, like, if I could figure out a way to help everybody show the value in their product, because there's value in every product, right? Otherwise, the founders wouldn't have created it. Even if that value is 3% of importance compared to what everybody else is trying to do, that 3% is still drastically important. And you got to be able to show people that 3%. So yeah, product is really, really interesting to me. Specifically product-led growth. So like, I want to be able to get people to show value in a product right away. I think that's really, really exciting stuff. And I think that's the best way that I can provide value is by showing people how to provide value.
And for people that would like to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do so?
Definitely LinkedIn. I'm still active on X, but I feel like I always accidentally forget to post over there. So I post on LinkedIn like 2 or 3 times a day, and I'm always on there. So LinkedIn is definitely the best place to contact me.
Fantastic. It's what worked for us, so I can definitely recommend it to others. Michael, thank you for your time, for sharing your knowledge, for not being afraid to share opinions that may ruffle some feathers, but it's healthy to get these conversations out in the open. Hope our paths cross soon and see you in some kind of CNCF event, Kubernetes event. I know you're very active. I'm speaking as well. So best of luck in all your future endeavors.
Thank you too.
Take care.